Good morning, everybody.
Now we can start easier.
Thank you for showing up there so we can start on that. Well, good morning, everybody. I'd like to welcome you all to the February 14th Happy Valentine's Day version of the Forest Practices Board. Is the microphone on? Can you hear me back there? Okay, great. We have a vastly different looking board than the last time we met. We'll do a round of introductions. Vastly different looking board. It's not clear. Patricia, can you tell us if TVW is rolling today? No, they're not. Okay. The room is being wired to do that in the absence of additional cameras, so it's not entirely clear, though. So we are not rolling with TVW today. So before we get going, I'd like to ask Patricia to do our safety briefing.
Good morning and welcome to the Natural Resources Building. This is a new exit route, so please listen carefully. In the event of a fire, alarms will sound and flash. Please leave this room using the double doors in the front of the room. In the event of an earthquake, alarms may not sound and flash. Please drop to the floor and cover your head as best as you can, or go under a table. After the shaking has stopped, leave this room using the double doors. In the event of any evacuation of the building, staff will lead you out the building using the double doors in the front of the room, then the first door on your left, moving west toward the parking lot along Washington Street. There, DNR employees are trained and equipped to assist you in checking in and responding to emergencies. At this time, I ask that you silence all noise-making devices. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Patricia. So I'd like to have the board members go ahead and introduce themselves. We'll take a moment with some of the new board members to feel free to give another sentence or two about who they are. And we want to welcome our new board members. It's wonderful to have a full board. We're a 13-member board, and I think this is, well, I know this is the first time we've had the entire full board since I've been chair. So thank you all for showing up on short notice. You've been recently appointed, and for the members of the audience, we're going to do a training this afternoon with the new board members. So we're very excited to have everybody here. And with that, Jackie, if you can start on the end.
I am Jacqueline Ford. I work with the Washington State Department of Agriculture, and happy to be here.
Hi, I'm David Whipple, Director's Designee for Department of Fish and Wildlife, and just for the new faces on the board, I've been in forest practices and forest policy for quite a while, and served a couple stints on the board in the past, and filling in for our director and our designees.
Hello, I'm Bob Gunther, and I'm born and raised in Lewis County, and I'm really pleased to be here, and I'm looking forward to contributing everything that I can possibly contribute to this group.
Excellent. And I'll ask, please speak into the microphones for the back of the room.
Norm Schaff, general public member.
Hi, I'm Carmen Smith. I'm a new member. My husband and I have R.L. Smith Logging, contract loggers, mostly Grays Harbor, Pacific County, for Rainier and Hancock at the time.
Morning, everybody. I'm Tom Laurie, Director's Designee from the Department of Ecology.
Okay, good morning, everybody. Bridget Moran, Chair of the Board from the Department of Natural Resources.
Good morning. I'm Dave Summers, Snohomish County Council, representing counties.
Hi, I'm Phil Davis, a new board member. I had a 25-year business career, and then about 6 years ago got involved in the nonprofit world as the Executive Director of the Hobe River Trust. I'm currently on the board of the Hobe River Trust and on the board of the Met Out Conservancy. In addition, I'm on the board of two corporate for-profit boards.
Hi, I'm Paula Sweeney, general public member.
Good morning, I'm David Herrera, general public member.
Good morning, Mark Calhoun, director of SESME for Department of Commerce.
Good morning, my name is Bill Little. I'm a board member representing timber unions.
Excellent. Well, thank you, everybody, and again, welcome to our new board members. Both myself and the staff will do our best this morning to try and make things as clear as possible for you. I've spoken with each of you a little bit individually, but we will. Anything that you have any questions about, please feel free to ask. No question is a dumb question. This is a very rich in detail subject, as many of you are aware, and so we want to make sure that any questions you have are appropriately answered, so please feel free to do so. Before we go into the rest of our agenda, I do want to take a moment and recognize two former board members who are here with us this morning. Both Sherry Fox and Doug Stinson are here, and if you could both please come up. I saw Sherry come in. There she goes. There you are. So Sherry served on the board for how many years?
Nine.
One of our longest board members. And Doug?
Eight
years. So I'd like to be offering you a plaque of gratitude today, but I'm presenting you a mere representation of a beautiful plaque that will be But we do thank you for your service on the board. I know we had a lot of good discussions with both of you, and you both represented your communities very well. So I want to thank you for your service to the board and have this as a placeholder for the proper plaque that will be delivered to you. And again, thank you for your service and anything you want to say in departing the board? Dangerous thing to offer.
Well, I do want to thank all of you that worked with us on the board to accomplish some pretty big things. And also thanks to those that sent me well wishes. I was feeling very good. So it's been fun.
A little more enthusiasm.
It's been fun.
Yeah, there we go. Excellent.
Well, I would like to say it's a very important board. It's a great 8 years, and you have a huge task ahead of you. We've got a great, we have great forests in the state, and we're going to keep you great forever. And I get to go out and tend my forest. Go for it.
All right. Well, thank you both. Okay, the next item on our agenda is approval of our November 8th board minutes. Is there a motion?
I move approval.
Second.
Thank you. There's been motion seconded for approval of the November 8th meeting minutes. Those have been sent out to staff, to all the board members. Is there any discussion? Yes, Tom, sorry.
Yeah, I have some changes to Stephen Bernath's testimony. So on page 10, it's the very top portion. It's the forest and fish policy workers' priorities. Evidently, there were actually just two top priorities, and this talks about three, so I can just read it the way it's supposed to be. That would be most convenient. I think that Patricia has a kind of a strikeout version of this, so that.
Okay, we'll project that.
Oh well.
While that's going.
Can I just ask who moved and who seconded?
Tom moved. Norm seconded.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Okay. So it actually goes a little bit further than what is up there. So it should read.
It's coming.
Oh, there it is. Okay, well, there it is. There are two priorities, not three. Complete tie-in strategy, clean water assurances is one priority. The other one is develop a recommendation to the board on tight FN water tightening issues, including a permanent water tightening rule. And then the rest of that is struck. Thank you, Patricia, for having that in advance.
Okay. Any questions or discussion? So board members might recall that when Stephen presented the list of priorities at the last board meeting, we had asked them for a prioritized list at the board meeting prior to that. And when they brought forward what appeared, at least to me as the chair, a variety of priorities, I asked them to put them in priority order rather than them being one lumped priority. So this does kind of get to that issue about whether there's one or three or two or however many, but I know we have met since then and have made progress on this topic, so I don't see this as a particular problem. Any board member want to discuss, or can we approve this change? Okay, so noted. Any other conversation or question about the minutes? Okay, hearing none, I move to call the vote on the November 8th meeting minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Any abstentions? Okay, motion carries. I neglected to have the DNR staff introduce themselves. My apologies to the board. So all the DNR staff that are in the room, if you could please introduce yourselves.
Trisha Anderson, DNR, Rules Coordinator for the Forest Practices Board.
Shay Martinez, Forest Practices Division.
Mark Jingle, Assistant Division Manager, Forest Practices.
I'm Phil Ferrister, Assistant Attorney General and Counsel to the Board.
Darren Kramer, Forest Practices Division Manager.
Gretchen Robinson, Forest Practices Division, Policy and Services Section.
I'm Tammy Makita, I'm the manager of the Small Forest Landowner Office.
Michelle Peterschick, I'm the Education and Grant Writer for the Small Forest Landowner Office.
Great. And we have a couple of other DNR staff that have stuck in the back. Why don't you guys go ahead and introduce yourselves, please?
Good morning. My name is Andy Hayes. I'm a policy specialist in our policy office here at DNR.
Good morning. My name is Lauren Burns. I'm an Northern Stock Representation Team.
Again, I'm working on the Small Forest Landowner
Office. Great. Thank you all. Okay, moving on in our agenda, the next item is a report from the chair, and I wanted to just update you on a couple of items going on. First, we're going to have a discussion in a little while from Darren regarding the active legislation for this session. But I did want to call your attention to one piece of legislation, that's Senate Bill 6406. That bill is in play right now, and that is a bill that would integrate hydraulic project approvals, or HPAs, which are currently under the jurisdiction of the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, into the Forest Practices program as an issue through the Forest Practices application. Many of you are aware that we do issue HPAs for non-fish bearing streams, and this would be a change to implement the Forest and Fish Report, which directs us over time to integrate all hydraulics into the Forest Practices permitting process. So there's a bill that's active to do that right now. It is commensurate with a fee increase that takes application fees from $50 to $150 for Class 2, 3, and 4 specials, and changes the forest practice fee from $500 to $1,500 for a Class 4 general, which is a conversion of forestry to non-forestry uses. So that bill is active in the legislature right now. We've been partnering with Department of Fish and Wildlife as well as WFPA in trying to ensure that any change to that bill is and the fees associated with that would lead us to a successful implementation of that new responsibility. So that's been an active dialogue. I expect that it will remain an active dialogue. The legislative process is upon us, and so can't predict the outcome of that, but it is an area that has a lot of potential impact to this board. There will be necessary rule changes that would come through the board to incorporate the Department of Fish and Wildlife hydraulic rules into the Forest Practices rules. So there's a process and an expectation that this board would be involved in, and I wanted to make sure folks had an awareness that that was happening. Like any piece of legislation, we don't know what it's going to look like until the governor signs it. So just wanted to make sure, given the potential for a significant impact, for folks to be aware of that. Any questions about that? Okay, so that's one item. Also wanted to let folks know that we discussed at our last board meeting that last legislative session we had a bill, House Bill 1509, which was FREP reform. That's our Forest Riparian Easement Program for small forest landowners. We had a reform bill that passed that required rulemaking that we'll hear about later, but it also directed the chair of the board, or their designee, to convene a group of stakeholders and pull together a list of suggestions and a report back to the legislature by May 31st of this year on permanent funding solution and suggestions for the Forest Riparian Easement Program. We kicked that off Last week, we put out a press release and invited sort of a come one, come all to see who would be interested in participating with us in trying to come up with some creative ideas. I've been fortunate to have Craig Partridge, our policy director, chair that for me. He's going to facilitate that work group, and we had a great turnout the first night. I think we had about 20 or 25 folks here, a whole list of great ideas, which we're going to continue to refine and shape and have follow-up stakeholder meetings, and in the end, deliver a product to the legislature by May 31st. So good progress on that, and I think all of us, at least from the DNR perspective, felt like we got some really creative ideas that perhaps we hadn't considered. We sort of took the approach that no idea was a bad idea. Some did have a little bit of, applause and boos associated with them. But I think when you're seeking all ideas, that's to be expected. But a good discussion, and really just saw that as a kickoff to meeting an obligation in House Bill 1509. So excited about that, and we can keep the board informed as that process. Yes, Bob.
So thank you. Were the small landowners active in this discussion?
Very much so.
Thank you.
Yes. And I was pleased to see that it was not just the small landowners who showed up, but other agency personnel and other interested parties that came with an interest to help solve this problem as well. Yes. Last item I wanted to mention that last October 5th, 2011, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service published a Federal Register notice that impacted the marbled murrelet. It did not have an impact here in Washington, and we neglected to mention it at our November board meeting, but it essentially removed a considerable acreage of critical habitat in Northern California and Southern Oregon. And since then, there's been a lawsuit challenging that, and I wanted to just make sure the board was aware of that. Typically, any Federal Register notice that comes through that has any potential impact to any activities that the board has responsibility over, the board staff screen those and bring those to the board at the next board meeting. However, because it didn't affect any of the rules or any of the activities here in Washington, we didn't bring it forward. But given that there's now litigation, and people may be aware of that, and it could have implications broadly for how critical habitat designations are done, we wanted to make sure the board was aware of that, and we'll make sure that we go ahead and send that Federal Register notice out to everybody so you have awareness of it. Any questions about that? Okay, now that's all I have from report from the chair. With that, we'll move into public comment. Patricia, bring our comments in. For the board members, for new board members, we do a general public comment period at the morning of each meeting. We have also begun doing those in the afternoon for board meetings that go longer. This is an unusually light agenda, which is why we're pleased to have you here today to sort of see how the board operates on a lighter agenda. But our intention is to make sure that those that wish to come and provide comment to the board have that opportunity. And the comment sign up for the general comment is for those items that we are not having a separate comment period for. So before any action that the board takes, we have a separate public comment period on that particular topic, but this sign-in is for those that have just general comments to the board that wish to speak to that. And like I said, we've added a second one in the afternoon so that those that wish to provide comment, if they can't get here first thing in the morning, they still have an opportunity to provide comments to the board. So with that, I will call up Bob Meyer. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. Thank you. I just wanted to come up today since there are so many new board members and welcome you to the Forest Practices Board and introduce myself. My name is Robert Meyer. I'm the environmental manager for Rainier. I've been attending board meetings since 1990 and have watched a large progression of actions by the board and see how they impact the environment and have improved the environment in Western Washington. today you're going to do something I think is great. You're going to celebrate kind of the final chapter in the recovery of the bald eagle. And that's been an issue that was early on in front of the board and the industry and landowners working together with the board, DNR, have created an environment where bald eagles are plentiful and they're able to be delisted. And this is finally to, we'll recognize the efforts of landowners by reducing some of the restrictions that were previously in place. It's also really a symbol of the achievements that this board has had over the years, and many things are not so distinctive as a delisting of a species, but there have been a great number of successes from this board. You're also going to address issues around cultural resources and providing protection there. And I do want to thank the chair and her staff for spending time with me so I could understand those and support them. So thank you. You're also going to play a critical role in the largest and most successful habitat conservation plan in the United States. Its impacts are highly visible and they're highly effective in the field. You can see them in the roads, you can see them in the riparian zones, you can see them in the wetlands protection, you can see them in a reduction of landslides, either from roads or on the hillsides. These again have been very important changes within the forest of Washington. The Forest Practices HCP is really an HCP in its own class, and just an outstanding environmental management system. Your decisions will also have far-reaching impacts beyond what goes on in the forest. The jobs of 40 to 50,000 Washingtonians are entrusted in your hands associated with forest products, and many others who work and probably don't even know of the Forest Practices Board, but their livelihood is also dependent on the forest products industry. Your decisions will impact local governments, schools and junior taxing districts, libraries, ports, roads in our local counties, particularly in our rural counties. You will impact the need for social services and the strain it places on government finances. You'll also be able to impact the climate change issues because wood is carbon neutral and it is energy efficient, and that makes it one of the top building materials in this country. It is also renewable, it's reusable, recyclable, and it's a great building product, one that we should encourage for the use of within the state of Washington and throughout the country. So again, I'd like to say that I'm very pleased with all of the folks who've been selected to be on this board, and look forward to working with you, and to the extent that you'd like to see the effects of the HCP and the forests, I would be very willing to take you out and show you our forests anytime. And I hope to get to know each of you much better in the coming year. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Next, we have David Powell. And as David's coming up, I want to ask that members of the audience, if you could keep your conversations to a minimum or step outside as you have them, please. The last board meeting, we had a difficult time for staff to be able to hear the board because there was so much chatter in the audience. So if you could keep that to a low volume or just step outside, that would be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and board members. Welcome to all the new board members and the old board members. I'm David Powell. I work for the Yakima Nation. And I'm here to support the new rule language for WAC 222-20120 that you'll be considering this afternoon or later on today. And it's a rule that deals with forest practices, being notice of forest practices to tribes and their areas of interest. And I serve on the TFW Cultural Resource Roundtable, which has been working on crafting this rule language. Over 3 years ago, a tribe and then an industry landowner brought it to our attention that there were problems with this rule. So we took it up, and with all the stakeholders, it's a long process. Everything we do is by consensus. But we've come up with this language, which we think is really good, and we believe that it's fair to the landowners, while it still provides an opportunity for tribes to meet with landowners and discuss cultural resource issues. And the Yakama Nation supports retaining the title. There has been a suggested title change, and the Yakama Nation is fine with the title change, but there's concerns with that, so we would be fine with leaving the title as it is. The suggested change adds, kind of specifies that the board practices concern cultural resources. The opening sentence of the rule, as it is now and as it's proposed, says that all forest practices will be provided to tribes. The rest of the rule concerns cultural resources and landowner tribal meetings. So the focus is there of cultural resources, but still it does cover all of them. So we support leaving the title as it is, but we really encourage the board to adopt the rules as the roundtable have presented them. It's 3 years of work, and we don't think it needs any more changes. I provided copies of a letters that the Yakama Nation has written in support of the language, and a copy of rules where we discussed that title change. And thank you very much. I'd be happy to try to answer questions if you have any.
Any questions for David? Thank you so much. Appreciate you coming over. And just a reminder to the board members, we don't have a separate public comment period on the agenda today because the public comment period on that rule closed. And so members of the public that are speaking to it now. So. Next we have Jeffrey Thomas and Andrea George. Good morning, Jeffrey.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Andrea.
Hi there, I'm Jeffrey Thomas. I'm the director of the Timber Fish and Wildlife Program for the Puyallup Tribe of Indians, and I'm here this morning with Andrea George from our tribal law office, and I want to go ahead and offer some comments on behalf of the Puyallup Tribal Council that they are prepared for today, and then I'd like to give Andrea a chance to make some additional comments if she'd like. So I have a letter here that's dated February 13, 2012, that's addressed to Peter Goldmark, the Commissioner of Public Lands, as well as Patricia Anderson, the Forest Practices Board Rules Coordinator. It's been prepared by the Puyallup Tribal Council, so it's a statement from the Puyallup Tribal Council regarding WAC 222-2120 rulemaking. I'll go ahead and just read it verbatim, and then be happy to entertain questions if there are any at that time. So here's the statement. Dear Mr. Goldmark and board members, the Puyallup Tribe of Indians has twice submitted comments during the rulemaking process for WAC 222-2120 regarding notice of forest practices to affecting Indian tribes. The Tribal Council feels compelled to indicate further concerns because there's been no government-to-government interaction up to this point. There's been insufficient notice to tribes. And there appears to be a general passover now to the committee from the board on the issues that the tribe had raised, since the board's agenda today doesn't consider adopting the rule. Let me start that again. The Tribal Council felt compelled to indicate further concerns. There's been no government-to-government interaction up to this point, insufficient notice of tribes, and what appears to be a general passover to the committee from the board, since the board's agenda today includes considering the rule adoption as recommended by department staff with no modification to the proposed language. Despite the dedication of resources to the rulemaking process, there's been no meaningful review to the comments that were previously submitted by the tribe during the CR 101 and 102 process. Instead of adopting the proposed language without fully considering the comments that were received, the tribe encourages the board to utilize the other resources to assist in the process, such as the Department of Natural Resources Tribal Liaison, Rodney Costin, the Governor's Office of Indian Affairs, or the Timber Fish and Wildlife Policy Group. Adopting the language as proposed may be insufficient for tribes and their efforts to protect cultural and natural resources. Thank you for your time and consideration of these supplemental concerns. Please contact Andrea George in our legal department or Jeffrey Thomas in our fisheries department with any questions. So with that, I'll offer Andrea a chance to make the initial comment.
Good morning. I'm here with Jeffrey to read the statement from the Puyallup Tribal Council into the record, but more so just to answer questions if there are any towards the Puyallup Tribal meetings. Thank you. Any questions? I guess I have one, Jeffrey, and that's if you have one as
well. I was just wondering if you had that in writing to share with us, the letter for tonight.
Here's our copy for Patricia.
Okay. We'll make sure Patricia makes a copy and gets that to all of us. For the new board members, maybe we'll discuss this when we get to the rulemaking portion of our agenda. But the rule language that is before us is a consensus recommendation of the Cultural Resources Roundtable. And it's my understanding that you're the co-chair of that roundtable. I just want to make sure that the group, the board is aware of that. Okay.
That's right. And maybe just to speak to that situation, of course, it's difficult for the roundtable group to address every possible topic that might be brought to its attention. It's especially difficult for the roundtable group to prepare a consensus recommendation that it can then present to the board for rulemaking consideration. The topics that the Puyallup Tribe is referring to in the comments that it's provided through both the CR 101 and the 102 process were brought to the attention of the roundtable group originally, and they did not choose to embrace them and actually thought that they weren't really appropriate for the objectives that they were targeting for the time or the provisions that they were trying to establish. And so the Puyallup comments about pertaining to what they would prefer to see provided as modifications to the rule didn't fare well in that process, and so we submitted them to the board for the 101 and the 30-day and the 102 review processes. From what I know, there's never been any effort on behalf of any of the TFW community to reach out to the tribe and better understand its concerns, let alone try to resolve them. And so that being the case then, we're here once more saying we believe those concerns have merit. We recognize that they may be concerns that are outside or possibly outside the purview of the TFW Cultural Resources Roundtable and may be more appropriate for resolution through the TFW Policy Group, the DNR Tribal Liaison, the Governor's Office of Indian Affairs, or other groups that might otherwise be more responsive or appreciative of the concerns that the tribe has raised. We're concerned that to send it back to the roundtable group may not be necessarily fruitful, and that if you do send it back to the roundtable group, the best idea is to provide them with a facilitator and probably resolve the issues in a workshop fashion, as opposed to expecting the committee, the roundtable group, to use its regular monthly meeting times, especially limited every month.
Thank you for that clarification. Appreciate that. I just wanted to point out that despite Jeff's participation as the co-chair in the roundtable, that you did submit comments during the CR 101 process back in June of last year, and then we again submitted comments in early January. And not only has Jeff been involved in the roundtable, but I also attended the meeting, and the roundtable members informed us that we were going to have to wait until the CR 102 process to have those concerns addressed. But at no point has the tribal council been contacted or either of us to further discuss what those comments have been. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, Peter Hyde. Morning, Pete.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair, and welcome to the new board members, thank all of you. I particularly want to thank the new board members, and particularly those that are volunteering for this job, and all of the board members who have to travel a distance to come here for the quarterly meetings and other board affairs. I have also have some comments that revolve around the 21-20 rule, but they don't have anything to do with the rule specifically. In your packets, I believe you received the comments that were submitted during the public comment period, and I had submitted a written comments at the hearing, but also a second comment later by email shortly before the close. I think about 2 minutes before, 1 minute according to this, before the comment period closed. But in that email, I had made some comments regarding the potential uncertainty of staff and how this rule would be implemented. And I particularly mentioned Donnell Mahan, who's recently appointed to an assistant division manager for operations. And at no time did I feel that the ability or the knowledge of the staff was a question here. There was simply I listened to a telephone conversation and heard some language that I was just a little bit concerned about. So I just want to let the board know that I have every confidence in the ability of the DNR staff, the division staff people. And Donnell particularly is an excellent choice for that position. And I don't in any way want to impinge on their on the integrity of that division. So I just wanted to be sure you understood that. And just to follow up, Bob and I did have a meeting with the staff, and those uncertainties were completely cleared up. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Pete. Appreciate you coming forward today with those remarks. Next, we have Peter Goldman. Morning, Peter.
Good morning. Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Peter Goldman. I'm the director of the Washington Forest Law Center, and we represent the Conservation Caucus involved in forest practices, and that consists of the Washington Environmental Council, Conservation Northwest, Wild Fish Conservancy, the Sierra Club, Olympic Forest Coalition, Pacific Rivers Council. And I'm also the designee to the Forest and Fish Policy Committee, and my colleague Chris Mendoza, who will be speaking after me, is the science representative to that committee. First, I'd like to welcome all the new board members, and it's an important time, and thank you for your service. I'd also like to thank the chair and DNR staff for all the collaboration we're receiving in the area of biomass, looking into what's necessary for the biomass, either BMPs or regulation, the Northern Spotted Owl implementation team, compliance monitoring issues, water typing issues, and adaptive management structural issues. It's been an unprecedented amount of cooperation with DNR and a very constructive relationship, in my opinion. Very quickly, I just want to suggest that it's not every day that an environmentalist comes up and argues for regulatory reform, but it's something that I've said before, and I invite the chair to convene some kind of discussion on it. There is the whole world of private certification, forest certification systems out there. I think it has great potential to both meet the viability of the timber industry and also to promote environmental values. And there's also, of course, our regulatory system, which has its own amount of paperwork, as all of you know, too. At one point, should maybe these systems respect one another? And should there be some regulatory adjustment, a fast-track permit system, a truncated review system, some kind of exemption from the state rules for landowners who agree to achieve high certification of their lands? It might be a very interesting concept that would both reduce the amount of regulation that landowners are subject to. It might catalyze the market for certified products, and it would not be a governmental kind of thing. It would recognize that there is a fair bit of work and commitment in getting forest lands certified and monitored over the certification procedures. A lot of questions, a lot of potential pitfalls for that kind of strategy, but I think it's something that maybe in our work plan, at one point, there should be some kind of task force that looks into that and maybe makes some recommendations on paths to proceed. I do see a lot of overlap, and it would be nice to catalyze a certified, a very high, highly protective certification system in that fashion. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments, Peter. I hope the tape is rolling. I genuinely appreciate your comments about the level of collaboration and your remarks, so thank you. Chris Mendoza. I see the red light.
Good morning, Chris. Good morning, Madam Chair. Good morning, members of the board. I appreciate my colleague's introduction here as the science representative for the Conservation Caucus. However, today, as noted on the sign-up sheet, I'm speaking as a public member, not representing the Conservation Caucus. And I'd like to speak today briefly about the FREP program and small forest landowner issues as they pertain to both FREP and alternate plans. I apologize for missing the meeting last week on that. I had a parent scheduling issue, but at any rate, I think that I've spoken before the board before about the challenges of achieving alternate plans and achieving FREP and balancing landowner needs with the protection of natural resources. And so I won't go over that again. However, I think that there a solution exists to some of the problems concerning having small forest landowners develop alternate plans. In other words, alternate plans to the current rules that, as the rules state, achieve protection of public resources at least equal in overall effectiveness as provided by the Act, meaning the rules. So that's the catch. However, I think that there are unique landforms out there that allow you to do that without meeting existing metrics in the rules, for example, base area targets and other things. To me, it seems reasonable that landowners meeting those alternate plans and having DNR come up with a more landowner-friendly, streamlined process on how to get there would help alleviate the FREP fund. As everyone knows, the value of riparian zones prevent us from buying them all up. There's just too many of them and they're too valuable, so FREP will never, there'll always be a waiting list. However, landowners needing alternate plans may not need FREP because they would hence be taking the value out of the trees they could harvest that they otherwise would not without the plan. So one thing the board might consider is exploring the opportunity for landowners that cannot meet alternate plans to be applicable to FREP. In other words, they do not have those landforms that would allow for those deviations from the regular rules. Well, reaching out to small forest landowners that can do alternate plans and hence harvest trees that would otherwise not be harvested under the current rules. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Chris. Yes, hold on a moment, Chris, please. North, a question?
Yes, Chris, thank you. You referred a couple of times to specific landforms. Do you have a list of those for us, or can you provide that?
Yes, I do. I don't know if I can provide it now, but I think as an example, you have certain landforms that have been used in other forest management schemes where you, I guess the best example is something called a break and slope. I think most people are aware that some streams have very steep hill slopes that break off into a flat surface near the top. Some of those narrower valleys essentially get most of their functions from right off that break, and regardless of the distance it is from the channel bank. So that's probably the best example of where you have a broad rule applied over a highly variable landscape that may provide overprotection in some cases. Arguably, it may provide underprotection in other cases, which is, I think, again, important. It's important to recognize the nature of those landforms, where they lend themselves or not. In fact, I think probably one of the best examples is the problem we had with that template, small landowner template, is it was kind of pushing the limits on the other end. In other words, if you get too close to regulatory issues or reforms, as Mr. Goldman pointed out, like the Clean Water Act, you can't really apply it as a template because you risk applying it over areas that don't meet those sorts of functions. But there are landforms that do. So that would be one example, I think, where you could probably do something like that. The only other thing I would add is I think that from DNR's standpoint, having done some of these alternate plans in a past life, meeting overall effectiveness of the rules does not translate into meeting the metrics in the rules. So I think that's something that, from the regulatory side of things, it's something that needs to be further worked on.
Thank you for your comments. Okay, next we have a former board member, Sherry Fox. Did you wish to provide comment, or were you just saying? Oh, we'll have a separate comment period on that.
Sorry,
okay. Okay. quite all right.
I'm not used to that.
We'll get you trained. Okay. And last, I have Rick Dunnington. Okay. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Board. Thanks for the opportunity. And I don't have anything written. I was driving up from Portland. It dawned on me this is a great opportunity. I thank you for the opportunity to get before you today. And just, I need to give a 30,000-foot view again of things that are going on, because all of us get so worked into the details sometime that we lose view of what we're really trying to achieve, I think. And for the record, my name is Rick Dunning. I'm speaking as one of the 200,000 small forest landowners in the state, 90,000 of us that have 10 acres or greater. We own millions of acres. We'll work on that somewhere between 3 and 5. But the bottom line is we have a huge importance to the state of Washington and its resources. And I was driving up from Portland today because I was honored to be able to meet with a group of 30 national tree farm spokespeople in Portland, Oregon over the last couple days to discuss how to stop the loss of this important land across the nation. And as I spoke with people from Iowa and New Hampshire and all the states were represented there, and quite a great group, people that really cared and dedicated their lives to this, there's common themes that come out. It has to do with the age of our ownership and the difficulty in transferring the land and state taxation and a whole host of issues that we have to look at nationally. But none of the states have to deal with small forest landowner issues in the regulatory battles like we do here in Washington State. And that's the 30,000-foot level thing I just want to bring to everyone's attention. While our association, which is light in a budget, and we're only 1,250 families of those 90,000 out there, while we try and engage and do the right thing, and God bless Sherry Fox and Doug Stinson for all their efforts and years on this board. They were so valuable to us, and we can't thank them enough. But while we're in these battles trying to do the right thing and trying to be professional enough to come in and work with all of you and get results, we're not out there doing the work that the other states are doing, which is educating our members to be better stewards and providing the resources that we all want to provide to them. And that's what we do. And so I just felt I wanted to come in here today and give you that heads up. I'm really thankful to hear Peter and Chris start talking a little closer to our language. But when you start that tax force, please put a tree farmer on it too, so we can stay at the plate and show you guys that there are ways to resolve this outside of the difficult regulatory process we have today. So thank you for your time.
Yes, thank you, Rick. Any questions? Excellent. Okay. That concludes our public comment period. And, can you make a comment about a comment?
Yeah, comment about a comment.
Feel free.
Well, I'd just like to sort of follow up on Peter Goldman's suggestion about the certification. I was sitting here thinking, that's what we were trying to do with watershed analysis back in the 80s and 90s, was develop a process by which we could decide what the rules were up front, get through all the regulatory stuff, and then move on and get out of the permit-by-permit process a little bit. And this is another pathway to that. But I would really like to figure out how to at least have that conversation, because I think, you know, there's some real merit in, from a lot of perspectives. Environmental, economic for the landowners, et cetera, et cetera. And so I just would really like us to follow through this.
Great. Thank you for your comment. Okay. Next item on our agenda is our staff reports. And for the new members, the traditional approach we've done with this has been to have these staff reports provided to you in your packet. And then if any board members have questions on any of the particular items, the board, the staff that wrote that report will be available for you. So we do have a slight change to that today. We had a few of the staff feel a need to speak to a few of their individual reports. And I see that we have policy co-chairs wanted to give a presentation. Yes, okay. Come on up, please.
Good morning, Adrian. Good morning.
My name is Adrian Miller, and I'm with Longview Timber Corporation, but today I'm representing the policy co-chair. I'd like to introduce Mark Hicks, who's standing in for Stephen Bernath with the Department of Ecology. You'll notice there probably isn't a staff report for this item, which is why we wanted to give a brief verbal update of where we're at. Forest and Fish Policy has been working on three general areas, a little bit of the lean process that will be discussed later, and our two priorities that you discussed in the motion earlier today. Stephen and I have sort of split those two up. I'm sort of taking leadership around the type F. He's taking leadership around the type N. As such, I'm going to need some support on the type N piece, so Mark will be giving a brief update there. But I'll start off with where we're at on type F. Since January, we initiated a sort of a small group of policy people who were interested in this topic and seeing it move forward. Our first step there was to basically ask individual caucuses to go meet amongst themselves and try to understand what each other's issues were. Then in January, we had a meeting where we came back together and developed, I think, a fairly comprehensive list of what I would generally characterize as implementation issues. And so we've begun a process now, our sort of first action steps. We've actually asked the Department of Natural Resources to bring us some information back related to some of these items, particularly sort of low-hanging fruit, for instance, how people may use the DNR base maps in their planning and in the regulatory process. Things that I think we can clear up the concerns with information sharing or perhaps brief discussions and ministerial actions. And so that's sort of one group of those things, and that's ongoing. We expect to have some things back at the March policy meeting with respect to that. Some of the issues were a bit more substantive and will probably require a bit more technical work in terms of information. And I think there's still an ongoing discussion on whether we want to begin that process and sort of let the see if we're happy with fixing the symptoms, as opposed to really looking at perhaps some of the underlying concerns that some caucus members have. And so we're still working through on those more complex issues, which approach to take. With that, I'll pause, and if there are any questions related to type F, I'll take those. Otherwise, I'll turn it over to Mark for type N.
Questions for Adrian? Okay. Go ahead, Mark. Good morning.
Policy has done a good job at really getting out of the chutes on trying to make the type N strategy a priority. We established a chartered process, which involves both a policy subgroup as well as a technical subgroup, established a four-step process that if they go through that process, there's a really good chance they'll end up completing a type N strategy sometime, probably in late spring or summer. I'm being a little optimistic, but I think there's reason to be at this point. Right now, policy's focus is on moving through the CEMA research strategy, understanding specifically what those studies do and don't do, and examining the Schedule L1 goals and objectives and performance objective targets, as well as the CEMA goals and objectives, and making sure that those all reflect what policy thinks they need to be able to make decisions at the end of completing these type N studies. So everything's been moving really well, and I think everyone's to be congratulated for a real positive attitude and really trying to make this a productive effort. The technical work group also has been busy. They have been primarily focused so far in developing a revised survey for practitioners who are engaged in identifying where these type N streams are people in the regulatory realm who review those designations out in the field to better understand what's working and not working in the opinion of the people who are out there on the ground. They're also working to try to decide what to best do with a partially complete literature review that was done by the Environmental Protection Agency. And then we'll be moving on to better providing some recommendations to policy in the form of reports on whether further guidance is needed in identifying, on field guidance, to help identifying where type N waters start and end.
Thank you. you. So for our new board members, I'm sure that was acronym and jargon rich. The rest of us didn't get it, but bear with us. We're going to go over all that this afternoon. But the policy group, the Forest and Fish Policy Group, is a component of our adaptive management program from where our rules come. So we'll go over that with you later. We tasked the Forest and Fish Policy Group with bringing us a prioritized list to help us meet particular objectives we have, and they were reporting back as we have asked them to do in the past. So that all makes sense probably to the rest of us, but we'll go over that in a little more detail later.
But another hat that I wear is also to try to look after what we call the Clean Water Act assurances. And at your next meeting, I need to provide an update on where we are with these assurances. And some of what I just discussed is related to that topic. So hopefully we can find a little extra time this in the next quarterly meeting, and I can actually lay out a little history on this topic so that the jargon won't seem so unfamiliar.
Right. Thank you, Mark. We're as we come up upon topics, we're going to try to build in to each of those a little foundational briefings, because there'll be a number of topics, whether it's regarding owls or Clean Water Act assurances or what have you. Each of them has a history that the new board members are going to need to understand. So appreciate your offer to do that. We will take you up on it at the next quarterly meeting. Great. Any other questions? Great. Thank you both very much. David Whipple also wanted to provide a brief statement regarding the gray wolf, which is not in your packet as well.
Yeah, thank you, Bridget. Just to kind of fill everybody in, the Fish and Wildlife Commission for the Department of Fish and Wildlife adopted in December the gray wolf management and the conservation management plan. And we've been talking amongst some of the stakeholders, as well as I think in front of the board, over this past 6 months to a year while that plan was being developed and adopted, that we would, at the point in time that the commission did take action, we would take a look at the Forest Practices Gray Wolf rule. And so I just kind of want to give a heads up that while that particular rule and the assessment of that rule and anything that may come out of that assessment is not on the current work plan for the board, that is something that we probably should have put on there, and that Department of Fish and Wildlife is committed to look at with the stakeholders that are concerned about that. In the Wolf Plan, we make reference to the Forest Practices Rules needing to be assessed and possibly modified. And so we're just signaling that we're going to follow through with that during this year. We don't have a timeline yet on that, so I don't know what staff really want to do in terms of the board's work plan. But my goal is to develops kind of like a straw dog internally in the department that we think we can support, and then we'll go out to the stakeholders, kind of like what we did for the Bald Eagle Rule.
We certainly appreciate the coordination. You know that since the Fish and Wildlife Commission is the entity that establishes the threatened and endangered species and their management plans, those have implications for our rules, so appreciate you mentioning that. We'll probably have you work with staff and then make a proposal for inclusion or exclusion into how the board will address that. So thank you for the early heads up on that. Okay, did any other board members have any questions about any of the other staff reports? All those who wrote those reports are here in the audience for you if you have any particular questions. I thought they were all very well written and very appropriately submitted on time. Thank you for that. Okay, hearing none, we will move on. Next item on our agenda is Darren Kramer coming forward with a legislative activity update. Good morning, Darren.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the board. Darren Kramer, Forest Practices Division Manager. This morning you should have received a table that's like this. It has three bills listed on it. We're, I hope, getting close. Or near the end anyway on the legislative session. We've looked at, the division has looked at about 50 bills so far this session, original bills, and about 15 or so amended bills, as well as fiscal notes. And I've tried to boil that down to the three that are likely to have the most impact to the program. There are several other bills that we're watching, but these are the three that at this point in time appear to have either a direct or indirect effect on the program. And by direct effect, I mean it would change the statute that would affect our rules and likely require some sort of board action. And by indirect, it just means it affects our procedures or our workload or something of that nature. So the first bill listed there, Madam Chair spoke to this morning, that's Substitute Senate Bill 6406, and an act relating to modifying programs that provide for the protection of the state's natural resources. This is what we call the integration bill. We are focused primarily on part two of the bill. It's a three-part bill, about 90 pages. And part two is focused on the integration of hydraulic project approvals into the forest practices application. So the provisions listed there in the middle of the page are the primary components of part two. As I said, the focus of that section is to integrate the HPA into the FPA, and that requires board action to incorporate fish protection standards into the forest practices rules and a board manual to guide implementation of those standards. It provides DFW a continuing involvement in forestry activities, including setting the standards for fish protection and reviewing a subset of activities for consistency with those standards prior to a landowner submitting an FPA to DNR for review. It eliminates the 30-day review requirement that veteran board members are familiar with. There's a 30-day draft rule review requirement in the Forest Practices Act for WDFW and counties. The bill eliminates that step in the rulemaking, so we would simply follow the Administrative Procedures Act during rulemaking procedures. It increases the general duration of a forest practices application from 2 to 3 years and provides for the option of a 3-year renewal. And as the chair spoke to this morning, it also increases the fees for class 2, 3, and 4 special FPAs from $50 to $150, and class 4 general conversions from $500 to $1,500. Those fees only take effect if part 2 of the law takes effect and the board adopts rules by December 2013. So there are some triggers associated with the fees. Part three of the bill is focused on SEPA, and it mirrors the bill that immediately follows it, so I'm not going to go into that under 6406. We'll jump down to the next one, which is second substitute House Bill 2253 and Substitute Senate Bill 6130, modernizing the functionality of SEPA. And while this is primarily focused on ecology and SEPA, there is at least some indirect effects for the program, and potentially direct effects depending on what happens with rulemaking. So that bill directs ecology to conduct two phases of rulemaking over the next couple of years to update the SEPA checklist and increase categorical exemptions. Some are specified in the bill and some are not. It directs ecology to convene an advisory group to consult with them, to consult with during the rulemaking process. Planned actions may be exempt from further environmental review if significant impacts have been adequately addressed in non-project environmental impact statements up to that point. County, city, or town may recover expenses with a cost reimbursement component. It does exempt several non-project actions from SEPA, and lead agencies may be able to satisfy checklist requirements if the issue is addressed in local ordinances or regulations. Now, the issue with this, or the concern with this bill, about this bill for us, is that it potentially increases the difference between what the Forest Practices Act requires by way of SEPA versus what local governments require. Right now, all Class 4 general conversions require SEPA in the Forest Practices Act, but that's not always true at the local government level. Some activities are SEPA exempt today. So we have a little bit of a conflict today. This has the potential to create an even wider gap between the two entities. And so we want to keep an eye on that and potentially come back to you at some point about ways to sync them up in a better fashion in the future. The next one is second substitute House Bill 2238, substitute Senate Bill 6093, creating required investments in compensatory environmental mitigation with existing programs currently referenced in Title 76 RCW. This bill directs Ecology and DFW to consider allowing environmental mitigation to be accomplished through the use of the Forest Riparian Easement Program, the Family Forest Fish Passage Program, and the Riparian Open Space Program. So basically kind of a fee in lieu of type of situation for compensatory mitigation. DNR and the Small Landowner Office may be consulted to help identify projects, and the Ecology and DFW have to report to the legislature on successes and constraints or other opportunities to meet the intent of that law. And that's an indirect effect, not really anything the board would have to do. It's certainly something we would have to factor into our workload. So those are the three bills we're watching most closely. As I said, there's several others we're keeping an eye on, but these are the ones that we get the farthest and have the biggest impact on the program, as much as we can tell at this point in the session. Any questions? Yes.
Yes, is it a fair question to ask about the fiscal notes on 6406? What are the ones you're looking at?
Yes, certainly. I will try to remember. I don't have them in front of me, but I'll try to answer the question.
So I want to know, what is the fiscal note on 6406?
For DNR, there is a range. I believe it was the first year, the rulemaking cost was somewhere in the $700,000 range. And then from there on out, we were right about $900,000 a year to accomplish the work.
That's the bill I'm interested in. Okay.
That, which is offset by the new fees?
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Fully or even more so?
No, it's an even.
Okay.
Yes, it's even.
Okay.
Yes, Jack.
So have state agencies, other state agencies, taken positions on any of these bills? I mean, are you on the record as supporting or opposing these bills?
Other agencies have weighed in. Department of Fish and Wildlife and Ecology have been heavily involved in the last one, the environmental mitigation bill. DNR has been more in a support role, frankly, on that one because it requires their two agencies, which have more responsibility in that particular activity. And I believe, certainly on 6406, we've been partnering very closely with Department of Fish and Wildlife to ensure that both agencies can support the bill as written. Ecology has weighed in support. Ag hasn't participated, nor has Commerce, to my understanding, at this time. And then regarding SEPA, I don't know how the other agencies have weighed in, where that's at right now.
I can't speak to that either.
I don't know.
Ecology is weighed in.
Ecology, that's right. Yes. I've listened to Tom Clayman's testimony, and he is, they've been on the record in support of 2253. I haven't been personally tracking that one lately, but I believe you're still in the support role.
Yes,
that,
I am. Yeah. It's current form.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Other questions?
Great. Thanks, Darren. Okay, moving on our agenda. Next item is Jim Hockfett's going to come up and talk to us about the adaptive management review lien process. And Jim is the adaptive management administrator for us. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the board. Again, my name is Jim Hodvet. I'm your Adaptive Management Program Administrator, and for those, some combination or all of you new folks, I'll be visiting with you this afternoon and hopefully getting you by some of all the acronyms and shorthand that we use in the program, including things like AMPS and CEMA and L1, which you've heard, and policy, et cetera. At the November quarterly meeting, the board requested that the AMP conduct a lien process on the adaptive management program. At the time, however, they didn't indicate whether they wanted it on a policy program or a process or a CEMA process. To remind you, I think you had a representative from the Department of Agriculture make a presentation on lien. Lien is a process improvement technique used on processes that are repeatable, have steps that are repeatable, as opposed to, let's say, a program, an overall evaluation of a program. So With lean and with the lean improved process, we have to find either in policy or CMER a process to conduct a lean on. So the first step was doing what's called an opportunity, what I'm calling an opportunity assessment. And that is where would we get the most bang for our buck if we did a lean event? Would it be on a policy process or would it be on a CMER process? So the first step was to do that opportunity assessment. We hired a lean contractor, and he met with policy and CMER separately and went over some of their processes. The two groups voted on where each of them thought they would get the most value added out of a lean event. And basically the bottom line is that the contractor recommended through the votes and through the discussion that it be done on a CMER process. So if you go to page 9 of your report, I think you're in your folder for your binder. We have it's more than one process, but I'm going to call it a process. We have a process in CMER for designing studies, implementing the studies in the field, developing the reports, sending those draft reports through an independent scientific peer review process, and then responding to the review of those peer reviewers' comments. And that's what you see in these boxes. What the recommendation was to do an lean event on the first two boxes at the very beginning of the process, where we do scoping and study design. Part of the reason was because it's very important for policy and CMER to be on the same page as to what the project is about. And so in the scoping process itself, in developing a scoping paper, policy is involved in that. And so the recommendation, and I believe a good recommendation, was that a lean event now be done on the scoping and study design process. These things, between the two of them, can take as much as 2 years or longer. And so if we can reduce some kind of process time, either cycle time, get rid of some non-value-added tasks that are included, we'll be far better off in moving our projects along. So, next steps is to develop a work order that we'll put out through a master contract with the Department of Enterprise Services for a contractor to conduct that lean event. The one thing I do want to say, and I almost forgot to write this in my notes, I tried my darndest to have a report done by something to present to the board besides just an update on process, which isn't very satisfying. So in order to do that, we had to ask policy members and CMER members, and we did it through a letter to the principals as well, to be able to meet with the lean contractor at the very last minute. I mean, we sent the letter out. I asked for the two meetings with probably a less than a week notice. And got total cooperation from policy people, CMER people, and so because of that, I was able to present something to you.
Great. Questions for Jim? Yes, Paula.
So is it a budget constraint that is preventing you guys from being able to look at both a CMER process and a policy process? Could you just pick one? Or was it decided that you only really needed to focus on one?
We had, what you chose was to take, I think it was a grant writer budget, which was $50,000, mm-hmm. and do a lean event with the 50. Mm-hmm. At this point in time, I'm not sure how much one event will cost. I think if it's successful, and I think if we get something really positive out of it, I think a recommendation could come back to the board to do another one. Particularly if, for example, there's money left over and sufficient to conduct another one. But I think we're going to learn something from this process, that it might be worthwhile to have additional events.
Yes, sir.
Does the staff generally agree that the processes are inefficient? So in other words, are they ready to embrace sort of a new way of doing stuff?
Well, okay, so this afternoon you'll find out that, we're a multi-caucus policy committee and a multi-caucus CMER committee. So there's only two staff. One's me and one's a program manager, that project manager that works for me. So when I talk about the individual representatives of CMER and the individual representatives of policy. Again, representatives of the various caucuses. I think there's agreement that things take a long time to get done, but that's kind of the nature of a consensus decision-making process where the voting rules, everybody has to agree, rather than something like a supermajority, for example. I don't think everybody necessarily agreed on which process we should have done the lean event on, but I think everybody, most people would agree that somehow we need to figure out a way to tighten up the time it takes to develop a scoping document, a study design. We don't have too much problem with field implementation. But then comes writing the draft and getting agreement around all the wording in the draft, which then goes on to ISPR. So to answer your question, is everybody, I think you asked if everybody thought this was
needed. You know, needed. When you implement change, if the people that actually...
I think so, okay. Yeah. If we can get people to go through the lean event, recognize where the issues might be, they would be involved in coming up with the recommendations and how to fix it, then I think the buy-in is there.
Thank you.
That's a good question. Appreciate that. Other questions? Yes, Norm.
I think you've appropriately identified the probably the two biggest bottlenecks or two biggest opportunities, so that's good, and I look forward to hearing more about that. Sort of facetiously curious as to whether the policy group figured that the bottleneck was at CMER and if CMER figured it was in policy.
That's why we did the two-step process.
Yeah.
rather than picking one and getting my, I don't know who would have chosen which, but they would have probably gotten verbally attacked because no, the problem is over there, not with us.
Exactly. Well, that's human nature.
You got it good.
The really more substantive question is, when can we expect to see some results from this process as a report back to us?
I would like to say the May quarterly meeting. I'm not going to promise, but I'm going to try to make the that's the goal.
Great.
That's the goal.
Good. Thank you. I appreciate that effort to get that done in that time.
Yeah, it helps having the master contract with the state because we can get work orders out relatively quickly.
But what does that mean? What would come to us in May? A completed process?
Yes. Yes. Okay. Yes. Yes. I'm assuming that's...
A report.
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you, Jim. Good one.
Any other questions about the lean process? Great. Thank you, Jim. And our last topic before we go to break is the Taylor's Checker Spot Butterfly Annual Report. Good morning, Sherry.
Good morning, Chair, members of the board, and welcome to all you board members. I'm Sherry Felix, Policy Analyst with the Forest Practices Division. And in your board packet, you will find the fourth annual report on the Taylor's Checker Spot Butterfly. These annual reports implement, in part, the board's voluntary cooperative protection strategy for this species. In 2006, the board initiated rulemaking in response to the Washington Fish and Wildlife Commission's listing of the Taylor's Checker Spot as a state endangered species. DNR then led stakeholder meetings to explore and to understand the species needs and known locations, the types of land ownership and forest practices activities near Taylor Checker Spot habitat, and the merits of regulatory and non-regulatory options for the board to consider. In 2007, the board approved unanimously the voluntary cooperative approach recommended by DNR and the Department of Fish and Wildlife. This voluntary cooperative approach relies on four things: tracking of forest practices within 1 mile of butterfly habitat by both DNR and Department of Fish and Wildlife, conditioning these permits when Department of Fish and Wildlife believes the permit poses a risk to the species, voluntary landowner planning with Department of Fish and Wildlife to develop management plans, and annual reports to the board. I'm happy to report that for 2001, all 14 forest practices permits within 1 mile of Taylor Checkerspot habitat were determined by Fish and Wildlife to pose no potential risk to the species, and no protection issues arose during these forest practices activities.
Just tell us that time period again, please.
2011.
Okay.
January 1, 2011, December 31. And I believe Fish and Wildlife has a bit of an update for you too.
Yeah, just real quickly, I won't take up a lot of time, but I guess, you know, from the regulatory and the board standpoint, particularly for the new board members, this is one of, I think, two species that's listed either federally or just by the state of Washington, where the species occupies very localized and specific areas. This one, the other one was lynx. And this is the second one where, upon listing, we consulted with DNR and the stakeholders and came to the conclusion that a regulatory approach was not necessary, and that we had commitments from the major landowners that own these sites or manage them, in the case of DNR State Lands, that a voluntary protection mechanism was appropriate. And so that's what Sherry described, and the board went down that road. And so those that process results in the development of protection and management plans by the large forest landowners that own the majority of the sites. We have two plans that are done. We have one that is, we've received it from the landowner, and we're doing an internal review. And then there are a couple more which kind of are relatively unique, in that the landowner does not, they've assured us that they're not going to propose any management in that vicinity in the near future. We're still going to keep working with those, because I think that it's important to have something in writing, and I think that's what the board's emphasis is. And then there's another parcel owned by a large forest landowner that they are still trying to dispose of, and so there are some opportunities there for acquisitions. But we, as an agency, we continue to do quite a bit of butterfly monitoring on these particular balds, which lie within the forested context and the forested matrix, and that's why it's an issue that the board had taken action on, because it is in a forest land area. So we do a lot of surveys and a lot of restoration work in conjunction with folks like Joint Base Lewis-McChord and the Forest Service and TNC, etc. So restoration right now is a very critical activity, because we do have some issues with some parts of the some subpopulations in parts of the states that aren't doing very well at all. Other areas are doing better. So we're actively involved with trying to secure grant money and conduct restoration activities to try to help those sites out. So I guess that's all I wanted to contribute. More information is in the report that we do every year, and we will continue to bring reports as needed.
I consider this a fairly successful approach that the board took. It was definitely a question at the time if we needed to adopt more rules, and we had a lot of folks say it's a very unique geographic area that we could work individually, because we knew where these species were, and it has proven successful. So appreciate you pointing that out. That's not the traditional way, but it was one that we were seeking, a sort of more creative approach, and it has proven successful. But we have asked for annual updates to ensure that that approach is providing the protections that we wanted.
Just real quickly, thank you. Just acknowledge the landowners' efforts. You know, to not only protect these areas, but also providing access and in-kind support for restoration activities and giving us access to do surveys, et cetera. So I think we all, in our discussion, recognize that that was a very important component. It's not just to protect these sites and walk away, that they were going to need some active management, some restoration, and we needed some help from the landowners to do that. And so that's why we, another reason, at least, why we adopted this approach.
Great. Any questions for Sherry or David? Great. Thank you very much. Okay, with that, we will take a break for 10 minutes. We will come back at 10:40. So.